The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning. This is Kim Hammer filling in for Dave Elswick. Hope you're not too disappointed. Dave's out of town at a conference, and so I'll be filling in for him today. Got a pretty full 2 hours. We've got the Bible guys coming on from 7 to 8 o'clock. They'll be here to visit and to answer your questions. We'll have a dialogue, all things related to any of your biblical questions. But this morning we're going to start off with Jim Legrone, who is working on the ability or the to work to defeat the marijuana initiative here in the state. And then after that, I've got three lovely ladies that are going to be joining me online to talk about the resource centers for women here in the state of Arkansas. I will tell you from 9 to 10 o'clock, I've got Dr. Kent Corso, who's been a guest on my show, the KimHammerShow.com, on Saturdays here on 101.1 FM from noon until 1. This is Suicide Awareness Month, and so from 9 to 10, I've got Dr. Kent Corso, who's going to be calling in all the way from the East Coast. He's an expert in dealing with suicide, and I think it'll be beneficial for you just to have the basic information that we'll be talking about again with September being Suicide Awareness Month. But right now, I want to welcome to the Dave Elswick Show, Jim Legrone, who's a good friend of mine. We've worked together as chaplain for hospice. And Jim, thank you for joining me on the Dave Elswick Show early in the morning.
Yeah, and we've also been able to work a little bit on political things. So
just a few.
Good to talk to you, sir.
Yeah, you got a little bit of a history working on the political stuff, don't you?
Just a little bit. I've traveled the country and worked for various organizations, faith-based and others, and just had a great time trying to help America make good decisions. Now we need to help Arkansas make a good decision.
And that's on the subject of the marijuana. It's a issue that is right at the forefront of all the voters, possibly. Do you have the latest update as far as where we are with the Supreme Court and what they're making the decision on the ballots?
Well, we don't know. The court's going to do what the court is going to do, and so we still don't know when that decision is coming. We expect it any day. Might come today. Might come Thursday. But. No doubt by the end of September, but we wish they'd go ahead and make up their mind.
And what effect is that going to have for those that may not be aware that the signatures that were gathered in order to put it on the ballot? Talk a little bit about the gathering of the signatures and why it's even an issue before the Supreme Court.
Well, apparently those signatures, the Secretary of State's office, as you are aware of, did not approve that, authorize that. What's the right word that we're looking for here? They did not.
Certify.
They pulled the certification, correct. And so to me, that should let you right there say, well, this doesn't count. But what the issue is before the court is whether or not that ballot title is confusing. And it's our contention that it is. It's not telling Arkansas everything that's in it. This thing is 11 pages long. For you as a legislator, I don't know if you're aware of the senator, but the legislature, according to this amendment, cannot regulate it. You cannot do taxes on it. You cannot control it. It removes any accountability from the medical marijuana industry. They don't have to report anything anymore to the state of Arkansas. It just it takes it away from the people. If they want to change something in the law or you guys see something you want to do differently by law, you're not going to be able to do it. So it's written by the marijuana industry for the marijuana industry, and they give them an uncontrollable monopoly on what's going to happen. This is a dangerous drug. This is not your granddad's doobie out in California in the 60s.
well, for somebody to know what the term doobie means, you lived in there where I mean, that, only those that live then probably know what that means. But anyway,
that little marijuana cigarette, you know, I've had to study so much about this stuff. Just 1 ounce gives you on average 85 different those little marijuana cigarettes to smoke. Can you believe that? Just 1 ounce can go that far. And so you can buy your 1 ounce just as often as you can, you don't, as long as you don't have it on you, you know, as far as possession is concerned. Then you add 2.5 ounces that you get on medical marijuana, and this thing is just going to explode across our state. They know that. That's why they've written the law. Did you know you could locate these next to a children's home, a city park, a public school, a playground, homeless shelter? My favorite is drug rehab facility. They can go in there and work through their AA meeting or something like that, and then go next door and buy their recreational marijuana. But they're going to have no more laws on this, and it's not been a boon anywhere it goes, because illegal trade will increase. It never goes down. Go to any of the states that legalize this, because, you know, this is not the most honest industry. Senator, can I mention one more thing that just really cracks me up about this? 5% or less, if you can own that, you and I could invest in one of these things, and there's no background check. No criminal background check on a guy that owns part of medical or recreational marijuana dispensary. It makes no sense at all.
I'll read you a statistic. I'm looking at a report I pulled up on Smart Approach to Marijuana, and it about preventing another big tobacco. And it says the percentage of youth aged 12 through 17 years old using marijuana is declining faster in states where marijuana is not legal. And overall use is up in legal states where declining is non-legal states. According to a uniform survey of marijuana use conducted by the federal government across the states, the percentage of youth aged 12 to 17 years old using marijuana in the states where marijuana is legal was 7.7% versus 6.2% in non-legal states. So, you know, the indicator would be that in states where marijuana is not legal, there is less use by ages 12 to 17, which I know if you provide alcohol to a youth under age, you know, there are penalties and crimes that go. I wonder how it will be affecting those that provide marijuana to those that are 12 to 17, because first thing I thought about is, what's a 12 to 17-year-old doing with marijuana?
Well, and they're going to get it from their home. Their mom and dad have a party, and they put out gummy bears that are laced with that, and brownies and cookies and all of those things. I don't know about your kids, but my kids had a tendency to put their hand in the cookie jar when they weren't supposed to. What makes them think that they got a cookie jar full of marijuana cookies or a soft drink? Because this law removes any restrictions at all on the THC, which is the addictive part of that and the getting high part of that. There is no longer, maybe it was 4% in the 60s, but today, if this is voted in Arkansas, there's no limit. It'd be 99%. It'd be almost pure that way. Just to give you a couple more statistics, folks like to talk about Colorado. Marijuana-induced and involved children's suicides are up 140%. Since that, marijuana involved road deaths in Colorado, 1 in 4 since this passed. The commercial that talks about supporting police officers, that's very effective for folks, because we all want to support the police. They don't tell you the way the law is written. Only 15% of the 10% tax revenue will go to 15 of the 10, which means about 1.5% of this they're trying to designate for policemen and drug courts, et cetera. Listen, they set their own tax rate. How is there any industry out there, small businessman driving to work right now, wouldn't he like to be able to set his own tax rate to the state?
You know, this is, as I mentioned a while ago, Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and I was just reading one of the pages off this information sheet about mental health outcomes, and it says, furthermore, 2019 Colorado Toxicology Report showed the percentage of adolescent suicide victims testing positive for marijuana continues to increase. Between 2011 and 2013, 20.7% of the suicide victims between the ages of 10 and 17 tested positive for marijuana compared to 12.7 who tested positive for alcohol. So if you go back to that other sheet that talked about the percentage of increase in marijuana use by 12 to 17-year-olds in states where it's legal, you compare it against the number of the increase of suicides between the ages of 10 and 19. There's a direct correlation between states that legalize marijuana and the increased number of suicides in the 12 to 17 population. So I've got a question. Why would you bring anything into your state that's going to, by data, prove and show that the increase of rate of suicide among our youngest, most vulnerable population is going to increase? We're going to come back after break, Jim. Hang on 1 second. I got to go to my other guest.
Sure.
We'll be back here on the Dave Elswick Show. This is Kim Hammer, Senator Kim Hammer, filling in for Dave Elswick. Welcome back to the Dave Elswick Show. This is Senator Kim Hammer filling in for Dave, who is out on a conference. And so today I've got Jim Legrone. Jim, just a couple quick more comments about legalization of marijuana and your thoughts on it. The one of the selling factors of legalizing marijuana is, as you mentioned a while ago, that it's going to, you know, produce some income to the police. However, the percentage of income that would be produced in order to help police with salaries or whatever, measured against the liability of the increase in arrest and the workload on the judicial system and the cost to the state overall. You want to comment on the comparison of the two?
Sure, I can. And once again, we'll go back up to Colorado. So let's just do that. For every $1 they receive in tax return, in tax revenue from marijuana, they estimate it costs them $4.50 to deal with those issues. So actually, they're losing money. It's an amazing twist that they're trying to do to us. And if you guys see this as a legislature and you say, well, we've got to raise taxes on this, you're not going to be able to by law. It's just crazy. But they're spending $4.50 for every $1 they gain. That is not a good, you know, only the government can say that's good accounting. They can make money. You know, it's, to you and I, that wouldn't be making it.
All right. So let me ask you just real quick in 1 minute or less. So let's just say that state of Arkansas currently is generating, let's just say, $40 million in revenue from marijuana sales. And then you got to deduct all the expenses that come with it for the Department of Health, Department of Finance, for the crime lab. Don't forget the crime lab over there.
Right.
All the total expenses. If Arkansas was bringing in, say, around $39.3 million in revenue on marijuana sale for all the fees, registration cards, designated caregiver registration card, all that stuff, would it then be a fair conclusion based upon what Colorado is experiencing that you take that, multiply it to the fourth, and you would have what the cost to the state is actually going to be?
That's what their statistics say.
Okay.
So, and how do you determine how much of a human life, what is one life that's destroyed by this? They even, the marijuana industry admits that 10% of people will become addicted. The people that like abortion on demand, sex changes, CRT, the people that are lined up, anti-gun, they're the ones that want this to happen. They're the ones that want this to happen. Enough is enough. Arkansas doesn't need another drug problem.
All right. Very good. You've been listening, Jim Legrone. Jim, your capacity to be authority to speak on this is what?
Well, I work as a field director with the Family Council Action Committee, which is the political arm of the Family Council.
Very good. All right, Jim, I appreciate it very much. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks,
we'll get together and visit. All right, let's transition now to talk about the resource centers that are here in Arkansas. My guest for the remainder of this hour are going to be Shelley Lewis, who is with the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center here in Little Rock. And I got Donna Azell, who is with Caring Hearts of North Little Rock and Little Rock. And then I've got Janet Dixon, who is with New Beginning Pregnancy Centers in Benton. And ladies, thank you for joining me here on the Dave Elswick Show this morning. Let's start off. First of all, let me start off with you, Janet. You're down at New Beginning Pregnancy Center in Benton. Just talk about your program and what it is that you have to offer down there to the community. And if you want to expand beyond somebody that maybe presents with a situation of being pregnant, what other resources do you offer?
Okay. First off, thanks for letting us be on here to tell about our program. Here in Benton, we are open 3 days a week and hoping to expand to a fourth day pretty soon. So we offer free pregnancy tests and ultrasounds that are limited OB ultrasounds, which means we can confirm pregnancy for the clients, and which is super helpful for them to be able to go on and get on our state's Medicaid, pregnancy Medicaid program, and also WIC, which is very valuable for our clients, and we love to resource them over to that, and the Department of Health likes to send them over to us for that confirmation. So it's a pretty good partnership. During that process, we get to introduce them to all of our other resources. We have clothing, maternity clothing, and baby clothes, 0 to 2T. So they can earn our fake money that we make. And so I'm saying that publicly. We counterfeit money, and it's called Baby Bucks. And they earn Baby Bucks by doing good things for their family and for themselves, such as going to work or going signing up for WIC. Also coming to our center, making an appointment to come to our center. They earn bucks just making an appointment and keeping the appointment, which is a good skill to have, going to the doctor, that kind of thing. So they spend their baby bucks on the things that we have, and all those supplies are donated by individuals or churches or businesses. And anyway, we just have those available to them. They come in, we have volunteers who enjoy mentoring them. Most of our volunteers are older women who have already parented. So we love to become friends with these young women and give them any advice that they want if they ask. And it's really just a lot of fun for good relationships and good support.
All right, Shelley, how about you up at the Arkansas Resource Pregnancy Center here in Little Rock?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for having us on.
You're welcome.
I love being on here with my friends, Donna and Janet. We all work closely together to help our community because we have the same passion and heart for helping women and families. So just like Janet, we provide the medical part of the pregnancy resource, which is the pregnancy test and the limited OB ultrasounds. We also provide at our center, we're open 5 days a week now, we provide sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment. And we actually offer this as a standalone product. And I got to give a shout out to Donna Azell. When she worked with our center, she launched this particular service. And what this does is allows us to meet women before they are in a situation where they have an unplanned pregnancy, to help give them really great resources, show them love ahead of time, and make sure that they know about us when that unplanned pregnancy occurs, and hopefully speak some truth into their life so they start making healthier choices so they don't have an unplanned pregnancy. We also provide those connections within the community, and new last year was the abortion pill reversal treatment, and Donna, she may want to speak about that at some point, but she was with us at the time when we were able to help a young mother save the life of her child with abortion pill reversal. And so those are the medical services we provide. We also provide infant care, parenting education as well. It's all free. Just like Janet, they earn baby bucks and can come shop. And as you know, the setting healthy boundaries and helping our clients understand how to earn something is really a great skill to have. This education and baby boutique program helps them to learn those healthy habits so that they can carry those on to their family. Now, of course, we have families in need that haven't had time to earn points yet. We're happy to help them get supplemented any way that we can. And a new program we're wanting to launch over the next year is more of a social work program where we stay with the client, help assess their needs ongoing, and make sure that the referrals that we are sending them to or getting them connected to are successful. I'm right now, this is kind of in a new phase, but we're calling it the Care Connection Program. I'm working on it. So if there's any volunteers out there that want to help with that and that are in the social working profession, I'd certainly like to talk with them.
I'll tell you what, we got to take a break here in just a second. So when we come back, Donna, I'm going to get to you and let you have the mic to talk about the resources that you have. Real quick, in about a minute before I got to take a break, the Care Connection and what you're looking for. Do they need to be licensed social workers, or what's the qualification and skill set that they need to have?
No, they don't have to be licensed social workers. It could be someone that's been in case management before in healthcare or in other nonprofits. Anyone that's worked in that profession or has knowledge in that profession, even mental health counselors could all be good resources to help us launch this program.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break here on the Dave Ellswick Show in just about a minute. I wanted to just encourage you to stay on and listen. We're going to visit with these ladies the remainder of this hour. And then at 7 o'clock, we're going to have the Bible guys in, and we'll talk about all the questions. So if you have any questions you want to email in that you want the Bible guys to answer, get those emailed in, if you would, so we can have those for the 7, 8 o'clock hour. And then from 9 to 10, I'll be back on with Dr. Kent Corso. Dr. Kent Corso is an expert in dealing with suicide, both from the recovery side of things, but also the prevention side of things. And with this being Suicide Prevention Month, it'd be a good time for you to tune in and listen. And I would just say that about this, or this about that, that if you may not think you know anybody, but on any given day, somebody can present to you that may be showing you signs that you're not even aware of. So I would encourage you to listen between 9 and 10 o'clock, and we'll give you some good tips on that. With that being said, this is the Dave Ellswick Show. I'm Kim Hammer, hosting for Dave today, and want you to come back here in just a minute after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to the Dave Ellswick Show. I'm Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave, who's out of town on a conference. And for this remaining portion of the hour, we've got Shelley Lewis, who's with the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center here in Little Rock. And then we got Donna Azell, who's with Caring Hearts with two locations in North Little Rock and Little Rock. And then Janet Dixon, who's with New Beginning Pregnancy Centers in Benton, which I know there's a network of pregnancy centers around the state. And I appreciate you three calling in today to just share a little bit more about them, because they are providing a valuable resource. And I know that the primary goal is, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the primary goal is to just provide to the needs of women who find themselves maybe in the situation being pregnant unexpectedly, or they just need some guidance or support. But your net is bigger than that, in that it offers services outside of just that. So for just a second, let me ask you specifically, what are some of the services that you offer outside of that? And then, Donna, I'm going to come to you. Donna, let me come to you and talk about the services that you offer, maybe even outside the framework of just dealing with women who find themselves in a motherly way.
Yeah, so to talk just a little bit more about those services to pregnant women, we also talk to them about their options about pregnancy, because we don't want to leave the topic of abortion out of this. So although abortion is illegal now in Arkansas, except for saving the life of the mother, we still have women that are, you know, considering abortion, either going out of state or, you know, finding the abortion pill online illegally. So that's a real fact that we deal with every day. And so we have women coming to us in that decision-making process. And our goal is, you know, to educate them about every risk possibly that they could face should they choose abortion, and to also just educate them on, you know, the decision, you know, the option of adoption. That is something that there's a lot of misconceptions about adoption that we often get to clear up for them, to paint a, you know, the real picture of adoption and what a gift that is, to obviously the child that they're saving, but to the family that has been waiting for a child. Because as we know, there's a lot more families waiting than there are babies available for adoption. And then, you know, so as we're educating them to make an informed decision, we're encouraging them and preparing them to be the best parents possible. So, you know, we offer, as they were mentioning, the parenting classes, the pregnancy classes as well. And not only that, but we're connecting them with a mentor. So they have someone that is that they're building a relationship with, that they trust, a woman that has probably been through a difficult time once in her life as well, that can relate to her, you know, to really empower her. So things that we're offering outside of that, so fatherhood. That's a big deal that we don't talk about a lot, and that's an area that really that we're looking to grow. We need obviously more fathers involved in families. culture these days that the father's often absent from not only the pregnancy decision, but also when a woman does decide to parent, oftentimes fathers are absent from there as well. So we are in the process right now of building a fatherhood program. We have several men that have come forward from our supporting churches that are interested and in training right now to lead that up, and we're looking for more men that would be willing to do that. So we're looking not only to support that woman, but the family. So our goal is to build stronger families, just as Janet and Shelley was talking about as well. We also offer Bible studies. Alongside the parenting classes where they do the Earn While You Learn, we also offer Bible studies to grow them in their faith. We've actually seen many women come to faith. This past year, we have 14 salvations alone, and that is enough to rejoice about. So,
hey, let me give a plug for something right here. You talk about trying to work with the dads to become better dads, and that's a little bit of a lead-in plug. A couple of weeks ago on the Kim Hammer Show, which is a show I host here on 101.1 FM, The Answer, from noon until 1, or you can get it on the podcast if you can't listen during that time frame. One of the focus points was about a program offered through TANF, which is called Better Dads. And let me get with y'all when we get off the show today, or I'll reach out to Janet and work through her. But Better Dads may be a good program for y'all to consider incorporating there, because it teaches fathers or to be fathers about how to be better dads, and it's the basic principles that sometimes we just need to be reminded of. And you can be a good dad, but there's always room to be a better dad. And if you've never been a dad, you want to be the best dad that you can be if you're willing to step up in that role. Because just my personal opinion, a lot of the reasons we have the problems in society today, absent from the fact that Christ is being pushed out of the conversation, is that dads are not stepping up in their role of being a leader in the home and being present in that family's life. Do you find that to be a trend and a contributor to what y'all have to deal with?
Definitely.
All right. Let me also wanted to do this with the time we've got. Everybody's got a reason for why they're involved in something. Everybody's got a story for why they are making the commitment like you ladies are making for the resource centers that you represent. And so let me just give you the mic for a minute, and would like to hear your story as far as what it is that got you motivated, or what is it that got you involved with the resource centers to make the investment. Because I know that I think, Donna, you live in Hot Springs, is that right, and drive all the way up to Little Rock every day, if I got it right?
Outside of Conway.
All right.
Yeah, about 15-minute drive.
Yeah. So let me just open up the mic to whichever one of y'all want to go first. And I'll have to take a break, so I have to interrupt you. But just start telling your story about why you got involved to the level that you are.
Yeah, I don't mind continuing on for a second. So this is Donna. I was trained as an OB nurse and was in labor and delivery and worked in OB for years. But my passion actually for the Resource Center is because that's where I found my healing and my help when I needed it. So back in 2005, I was reaching out for help because of past abortion in my life, and just was realizing that I needed healing from that. So that's when I became connected with Caring Hearts. And went through a program called Save One. There's many abortion healing programs out there. That's one of them. And from then, I started volunteering. I was trained to do ultrasounds and started volunteering doing ultrasounds for women considering abortion. You have been healed from that in your life, you've accepted forgiveness and forgave yourself. You want other women to experience that, because there's many women, 1 in 3 women, not only in our community but in our churches, that have suffered from abortion and are living in silence and pain. And so that's where my passion comes from. It first was so that other women could find that healing, but then to help women realize, if they made that decision for abortion, just what they may be, the pain they may be in for the rest of their life.
Let me ask you, do the resource centers offer support services to people like yourself that found your you know, where you just needed healing. And maybe, yeah. you know, even in the church setting or even in the best of settings, you know, people may not know where to go. They may not know who they can reach out to that they can trust, that if they tell them that, that wouldn't be used against them, or, you know, that they would, you know, that might inhibit that relationship. So what services do you offer for those that have experienced abortion but maybe have never told anybody? Can they come to you, and is it a safe place? Is it a place where they can get some directions, some resources?
I'll let one of the other ladies talk for a minute.
Kim, yes, at the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center, we offer Save One, which is non-denominational spiritual healing format. It's a 12-week format, but we also are connected to several other post-abortive retreat-style healings and weekly studies. So we are the place that a lot of women come to first, because one, they're either trying to express their healing in some way and trying to volunteer, or they just don't know where to go. So yes, I know at the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center, that's something we're very passionate about. We have women that come to us right after having an abortion or 20 years after having an abortion. And we want to make sure that when we say we love them on the front end, that we love them always.
Shelly, I've got about 4 minutes before I got to take a break. What's your story that got you involved, that you are pouring your energy into the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center?
Yeah. Well, like Donna, I thought it was my a post-abortive experience that brought me here. But recently, Kim, God gave me the wisdom to know that that my very life, from the time I was conceived, was intended to glorify Him in this position. I was born of incest and rape, and I lived with that knowledge since I was 5 years old, and it shadowed everything I did in my entire life, and in fact, led me to having an abortion in my teens. But recently, I realized that God's proof of His love for me was in every moment of my life from my very conception. And He intended for me to do this very thing at this very moment for His glory. And that's why I'm so very passionate about what we do, and that's why I wanted to launch this Care Connection program, because there were many, many times that I went unnoticed and uncared for because somebody wasn't there walking alongside my mother and getting her connected to all the resources she needed to escape the situation she was in. And if I had only had that in my life, in her life, then I might not have suffered some of the things I suffered. But I'm so glad I got to suffer them so I can walk alongside other women with my open heart and compassion to help them find the things that they need to live the life God intended for them.
Do you... that's powerful. That's powerful. Let's do this. Let's go to, that was just a little bit on the overwhelming side for me. So, Janet, let me ask you in a couple minutes as far as your personal story that got you involved.
Okay. I would say, Shelley, that was powerful. We could just stop and start singing a song or something. I'm just praising God. Mine is, a little bit different. I felt a little call, not little, but a call to being a missionary when I was like in fifth grade. And then, just life as a teenager and young adult, I started doing my own thing. And so I kind of just put that in the back of my mind and I'm probably not going to ever get to do that, or I'm not qualified, or I'm not good enough. And anyway, God put me into nursing, and then I was able to get my master's degree and just kind of fell into women's health. And my specialty really was more preventive, and I became really involved in the schools with programs that we used to call the abstinence programs, and I was the STD lady. And it's just been really, really neat to see all of my experiences as a nurse practitioner doing family planning and talking about that, all of that, to make full circle. And now I'm actually getting to be that missionary I wanted to be in fifth grade and get to be in women's health too. And so there are a lot of things that I feel unqualified for, but I feel like Shelley so well put it, you know, just that God put me here at this time and prepared me in all kinds of weird ways for this time to be the director at New Beginnings. And so it's just been kind of a wild journey, but I'm really happy to be where I am. I'm not post-abortive, but I did give someone money to have an abortion. So I think it would be surprising to know how many of us in the church have been involved with abortion, and whether personally or, in my case, a little bit on the outside, but still involved, and that we have to just really accept that forgiveness from God for everything.
All right, need to take a break here on the Dave Ellswick Show. This is Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave, who's out on a conference. We'll come back, finish up the hour with three ladies representing the resource centers, and let's finish up the hour with them, and we'll come back after the break. Hi, this is Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave Ellswick here on the Dave Ellswick Show, 101.1 FM. I need a little more coffee. All right, we got about 5-6 minutes, so let me give some attention to a couple things. Number one, Shelley, is it you that's got a new resource center coming into Little Rock, or one of y'all do?
That's Donna.
Donna, okay.
Yes.
You can tell we rehearsed the show so well. All right, Donna, talk about where your new center is real quick.
Yeah, so we just opened in May in Little Rock, right next door to Planned Parenthood. So we are at 1515 Aldersgate Road in Little Rock. And so we intentionally, you know, bought the property, you know, adjacent to Planned Parenthood to be that close to offer, you know, alternatives to abortion. So that has just been a blessing. And, of course, you know, even once Roe was overturned and women can no longer get abortion there, we still are serving that population and seeing clients walk over needing STI services, needing free services, not being able to, you know, to afford some of the services that are provided at Planned Parenthood. So, yeah, so we're in a great location, just eager to serve these women.
I got a survey yesterday from Planned Parenthood wanting me to fill it out as a up for re-election so that I could get their endorsement. I'm going to send it back and say thanks, but no thanks. But the efforts are still out there to get women into states where that they can get abortions. Is that true?
Yes, actually, I was researching for my banquet that's coming up next week, and come across the Arkansas Times actually published on August 8th, after Roe was overturned, an article that navigated women on how to get the abortion pill and how to get an abortion now. Just in our, you know, just out there, a navigation tool. So definitely there are. Those associations that are really trying to help women get abortions.
All right, and talk about y'all's fundraisers real quick. I know there's a couple fundraisers out there, so tell people about that, how they can support, because all that money helps you not only guide women, but also focus on the, you know, let me reemphasize the resources. I know down there in Benton, when I went down and toured it the other day after, and we haven't even talked about the grant money that y'all are going to be receiving. Won't have time today to do that. But, you know, like, man, back there in the back, they've got diapers. They got a baby formula. They've got maternity outfits. They've got baby outfits. They've got, I mean, it's like a real true resource center. So talk about the two fundraisers you've got coming up so people can know how to help support it. And take about 30, 45 seconds each to do that.
Caring Hearts, we're having our fundraiser next week. It's our annual fundraisers on September 27th, and that's a Tuesday evening beginning at 7, and it is at the Doubletree downtown. Registration closes tomorrow, so if you would like to register, you can go online at chpregnancy.org, click our donate button, and it'll take you to the events page where you can register.
All right, and there's another one out there, too, isn't there? One of y'all.
It's Shelley with the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center. Our banquet is called The Legacy of Life. It's on October 27th, so you still got plenty of time to register for that. And you can go to St. Joseph's Helpers, ARK.org, /Legacy of Life to register. It is a free, completely free event, just like Donna's. We want you to come enjoy a great evening. And just a teaser, I will be sharing a fuller version of my story at that time. So I hope you'd come out and support our center, but learn more about how you can help victims of rape and incest.
All right. I tell you what, I'll get those up on my Facebook show or on my social media page for the KimHammerShow.com, and we'll see if Dave can get it up there too so that y'all can go get that information. The last minute and a half I've got, here's the one thing I want to stress, because you've talked on a couple issues a couple times this morning about coming at this from a spiritual perspective. But let's say somebody out there doesn't have a spiritual perspective. Let's just say they don't want to be preached to. They don't want to be talked to about faith. They just need resources. Real quick, talk about the environment that somebody would walk into, because that's maybe part of the fear people might have is that they're going to be condemned, judged, or whatever when they walk into one of the resource centers. So in a minute or less, relieve people's mind about that.
Sure. If you guys don't mind, I'll go ahead and start on this. So at the Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center, we've been next door to the only surgical abortion clinic for the last 35 years. We've been next door to a surgical abortion clinic. Recently it closed, praise be to God, but our whole stance had to be love first. So we love first, and the gospel was shared through love. And then when we had an opportunity, we talked with them about the gospel. But yes, our centers are set up in a clinic. Our centers are set up in a clinical way so that they get the care they need first, because that's what Jesus did for us. He gave us the healing first, and then our faith followed. So that's how we've always approached it, because not only our location, but we know that's the way Jesus wants us to reach people where they're at.
Very good. All right, you've been listening to Dave Ellswick's show. Kim Hammer, State Senator, has been your host today. Dave's out of town. We've had Shelley Lewis with Arkansas Pregnancy Resource Center, Donna Ozell with Caring Hearts North Little Rock and Little Rock, and Janet Dixon with New Beginning Pregnancy Center. You don't have to wait for a fundraiser to support these organizations. I'll get y'all back on again, and we can talk about further details, including the grants. I appreciate y'all being on the Dave Ellswick show. Coming back after the break, we got the Bible guys on. You can get your questions emailed in or call them in. We'll be glad to take them on air if you want to. And we'll be back after the break here on the Dave Ellswick Show on 101.1 FM, The Answer. Good morning again. Thank you for joining back here on the Dave Ellswick Show. This is Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave this morning, out on a conference, getting educated, come back and just share all that knowledge and wisdom that he's out gathering up. So I encourage you to tune back in and listen at a later time. But today we've got the Bible guys on from 7 to 8 o'clock. And if you would like to call in a question, you can call in to 501-823-0965. 501-823-0965. So, Billy, Steve, great to have y'all on the Dave Ellswick Show this morning.
Always happy to be here.
Yep. Y'all had a pretty good week. Sunday, pretty good worship service for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Saturdays for us.
Saturdays for y'all. That's sorry, my bad.
Well, I was at both.
Yeah, as okay. It's an all weekend long sort of thing, right? Yeah, it's a Saturday and a Sunday, but our congregation specifically meets at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoons.
Yeah. I was at the Sunday service as well, talking about the holidays coming up and some of the studies that we've got going on. So it was a full weekend for me.
Very good. Y'all get pretty good participation on your Saturday services.
Yeah,
we do.
All right. So what is it that y'all are preparing to talk about with the upcoming, you mentioned about the upcoming holidays, and I know there's some things relevant to the times going on. So what is it that y'all were talking about or sharing about?
One thing about, it was a year ago, I've just been feeling like most of the problems that we have in society, it always stems back to the church, right? The church is supposed to be the voice and the conscience, if you will, of the country. Of the place wherever the church lives, not just America, but wherever it's at, the people who are living out the things of God. And there's been a, as the Word of God says, that the people perish for lack of knowledge, and also that in there was another time where God said that he would send a famine of the Word. And so I just felt like that what we've got going on today is people don't study and dig into the Word anymore. So we started doing a year-long study of going through the Bible, a year-long reading. And then we also brought in a Wednesday night service to start going through a deeper study. And so we got a new study coming up beginning in October from a group called First Fruits of Zion. And it's a study. It's called the Beginning of Wisdom. And it takes us back to understanding the wisdom, the morality, the ethics, and all those things that you find in the Torah, in the first five books of Moses. And I say it this way. Orthodox Jews and conservative Christianity see almost everything identically except for who Messiah is.
Right.
And so then the question becomes, how is it that people who don't know the Messiah, who don't have the Holy Ghost, don't have the New Testament, how is it that they have come to understand how is it that we have the both basic same foundation? It appears that maybe all of that has been found in the Torah. And maybe that the apostles drew from that wisdom. And so we're going to go back and find those basic morals and ethics and wisdom and wise principles that you can pull from the Torah, because unfortunately too many people have the idea that the law is just a book of rituals and a book of what you can and cannot do without understanding the morals and the ethics and the guides that are in it. And that's we talked about that study, what's coming up, and then we've got the fall holy days coming up.
You know, and the Bible the Bible teaches that the law was written for the purpose of showing man's inability to get to God on the basis of his own good works, that he needed another pathway forward other than being obedient to the law. Although that the law is there to provide, mm-hmm. you know, for the moral structure of society, if nothing else. I mean, and you know, that's one thing I think people don't maybe take a look at the Bible and consider, is that the Bible is good. If you want a good, healthy, moral society, mm-hmm. in order to raise a family, in order to have a safe environment to walk down the streets in order to be able to have a strong economic environment, just a good overall healthy environment, the Bible is the best place to go for that, because it starts with God giving Moses, okay, here's the laws you guys are going to live by if you want to get along right with me and along with each other.
Yep.
Thoughts on that, right, wrong?
No, that's exactly it. I like to explain the covenants as the way God wanted to set up his kingdom. So he made a covenant. You walk through them and you hear one about the Adamic, the covenant with Adam, which is, hey, you're man, here's the earth, you rule over it. Then he made another one with Noah, saying, hey, I won't do what I just did to destroy the earth since you guys messed it all up. Then he made one with Abraham and said, hey, I'm going to give you some land to your descendants. And then he made another one with Moses and Israel about how they are going to rule and live within that land. I shouldn't say rule, the rules that govern that land. And then he makes another covenant with David, which is going to be the Messiah will come through his heir. So now we have a king that governs over a certain specific land. And so all of the covenants had a purpose, and you've got to have structure. I was listening to a podcast yesterday where there's a rabbi, and he was talking about how important structure and order is. And even when we talk about things from a scientific standpoint, about how God, in the book of Genesis, brought order from chaos. Mm-hmm. And it's the law of Moses brings order in chaos. And the reason, and anything that does that, you could argue that's what the purpose of our Constitution was. And we all know that it was based off a lot of the principles found in the Scriptures. But it brought order, right? And so why do we have so much chaos in our land today is because people aren't following that structure. They're not following the structure that was laid out by our government in the Constitution, and not following the order and the structure that was laid out by God and his rules. And so we've got to have – you have to have rules. And there's a church – a lot of people in the church have thrown off that rule, have thrown off that governance, and saying that we don't need law. All we need is the Spirit. And so since we don't have law, we have chaos. That's why we have violence in the streets and everything, and it's just chaotic. Sorry, Billy, I've been talking about
it. No. I would make the exact same point. The reason this country had been so blessed, and I did use the word had there, had been so blessed and had prospered and conquered, let's face it, we've conquered significant portions. We always turn around and give it back. That is the nature of the heart of this country. But the reason that has happened is because at our founding fathers looked around and went, okay, what is the model for creating a nation? Mm. And they went, well, here's the model that God gave Israel. And the vast majority of when you go look at those founding documents, and what you see is they continuously went back to the Word of God and mm-hmm. said, this is the way God expected a country to be run. And as a result, we had 200 years of significant prosperity. And only when we started going, you know what? We don't need a God over us. We're going to throw off those chains. Oh, my God, what a horrible statement. Only when we started doing that did we start this significant decline. To the point that, you know, you look around and it's number one, we're bankrupt. I mean, you know,
right.
Very few people would make that statement that way, but this country is bankrupt. You know, 31
on multiple levels,
right?
Right, yeah, right.
Immorally,
right.
Ethically, and financially. You know, we talk about the 31 or 35 or 40 whatever it is trillion dollar debt, but that doesn't even discuss the 300 trillion in debts we're going to owe at some point. Right, we're bankrupt as a country, specifically financially, but also and much more importantly, morally. We became financially bankrupt when we became morally bankrupt about 60 or 70 years ago at this point. So that that generation that had to go to war and had to face the two greatest wars that we've seen came home, and they were broken enough that the next generation did not learn the lessons they had learned and decided to take a different path. And as a result, this country has walked a road that we should never have walked, where we cast off morality, where we cast off rules. You know, I'll live my way. Well, I'm sorry, but your way is not God's way. Mm. Man's way is not God's way. Scripture's pretty clear about that. And as a result, we have bought into a bunch of lies that really have bankrupted us, specifically morally.
Yep.
You know, and that's one thing you talk about, those that came back, like from World War II. I'll even go to the recent war, you know, that we've had in the Middle East. Those that have come back from seeing the carnage that they saw changes the perspective of life, I think, to where they realize humanity, their humanity, and they realize what happens when chaos is introduced into the situation, which we know Satan is the author of chaos. He's the author of confusion. So his battle strategy is to introduce as much confusion, as much strategy, as much division as can be introduced in order to destroy something, because a house divided against itself cannot stand. And so for those, like the World War II, you know, when you see them respecting our flag, you know, respecting, just respect, period.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have a different perspective than some that have never been there, nor do they have an appreciation for the accurate accounting of history as it should be taught, that would bring into people's lives personally.
Yeah.
I wasn't there, but understand what you went through, or I at least have sympathy for what you went through. I think that whole mentality, that whole appreciation for what others have done is not in the picture.
Yeah. Peace is not appreciated until you've experienced violence. It really isn't. And we have, unfortunately, through technology and a smaller and smaller military as we've gone, fewer and fewer of us, fortunately, I said unfortunately, I meant fortunately. Fortunately, the vast majority of us do not experience the sort of violence that our grandfathers, or fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers experienced. Even in the way we handle modern warfare, unless you happen to be a very small portion of the very small portion, you're not experiencing that level of violence. We've become so soft. It is unfortunately kind of the historic nature of nations that eventually they become strong enough that they become weak, right? That we become so strong that it takes a super small percentage of people to maintain that until that percentage is no longer able to get it done. And the nation as a whole devalues what those who have come before had to do. And part of that is changing history, is a matter of changing the language and changing what we teach.
That's the other thing you were alluding to there, is about the historical. And it's unfortunate that some of the bad spots in our nation's history seems to be the focal point, right? A 10 or 20% period of time of overall what this nation has done, what it has done for the world in many of the conflicts, but also what it has brought to the world. I mean, the vast majority of the technological advances and the things that we see were created in this nation during this period of time that we're talking about. And yes, there were groups and segments of it that did some things that were bad and against the things of God. But at the same time, the reason the people don't love this nation is because they've been told about the bad spots only and not the things that are
well. And good. They've been taught lies about some
That's
of that
true.
Too. Some lies they've been taught. They've been taught an entire.
It's been distorted.
Cases, an entirely false version of what our history really is. And instead of focusing on there were bad things, but look at these men and women who went out and made those changes, they want to focus on what came before the changes. And it's like, look, that's not healthy. That's like a cancer patient, instead of focusing on the treatment, laying around in bed worrying about the cancer and not doing anything about it. It's like, look, we went out and we solved these problems, and it's only because of the political division that certain groups want to create that they are focusing on the negative, and that does nobody any good.
But if you've got to teach history as history occurred in an accurate manner, good, bad, or ugly, just teach it the way it actually happened. But then you got to have a value system that counters that bad experience by saying this is what they did then, and if it would have been handled like this, the outcome could have been different, or maybe could have been avoided altogether. When Satan attacks the value system of a country so that those bad experiences, when they're looked upon, are looked at through distorted views and through maybe even distorted teaching, then things don't align. I think that's where we get what we've got today.
Absolutely.
I mean, God told Israel, teach your kids these things. Remind them of what happened. It wasn't so they could be reminded about the good. It was so they could be reminded about the bad, because you don't want to go down this road again. All right.
That's good.
Got to take a break here on the Dave Ellswick Show. This is Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave today. I've got the Bible guys in. Glad to have Billy and Steve, and we'll be back after the break. And if you want to call in, 501-823-0965. We'll be glad to take your questions. Welcome back to the Dave Ellswick Show. This is State Senator Kim Hammer filling in for Dave. Out of town on a conference. Got the Bible guys in. I got two out of three. Got the best of the two of the three.
I wish he was listening.
Well, he better be listening. Yeah, if not, look, the phone's ringing. It might be him. But anyway, I got Billy and Steve in the studio. We're talking about biblical applications to modern-day problems. How about that?
There you go.
So we were talking about some of the issues before, and I just kind of made a random list here. Let's just check down it, because, one thing is God doesn't ignore an uncomfortable situation. Human tendency is to try to avoid conflict and run away from it, or just stick your head in the sand. God never did that with any of the challenging issues that we're facing as a society. He gave Moses the law. He said, if you guys stick with this, we got everything good. And I'm a lawmaker. I can't, we run about 2,000 plus bills a session.
Wow.
God did it in one short session with 10, 10 commandments. If everybody just followed the 10 commandments, think about how much better society would be. Think about how much less you would pay in taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Think about all the problems that would be solved if everybody would just be obedient to the 10 commandments.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm kind of condemning myself in a way as a lawmaker. We pass all these laws that you could almost take back to every one of the 10 commandments if you were to trace it back. This problem would be fixed if you just do one of these 10.
Yep.
And also, can you imagine this would be my weekly jab at lawyers. What the Ten Commandments would look like if they were put together by a team of lawyers, right? And all of the wording, they wouldn't be so simple. In the Hebrew, it literally says, do not steal. It says, lo steal, no steal. That's all it says.
Don't steal.
It's really that simple. But I'm sure that if the lawyers got a hold of it, each one of them would probably be 2,000 words long to help describe what it means not to steal. And that would probably be the... would be as many bills if they didn't have to add so many words, and if we would just do those simple things.
People want to make God out to be complicated. Really, he's pretty simple.
He is.
He's a do and don't, black and white kind of guy. And so if we could get back to that.
Yep.
But in the meantime, until we do get back to that, let's take on some modern-day topics that are kind of pushing people's button. Talked about debt a while ago. If we were to do it God's way, how would it be? We would not be in the debt situation we are as a nation.
Yep. Anybody who is in debt, the Bible says, is a slave.
Yep.
Because you are subservient to whoever lent you the money. and we are servants, slaves. It's the same word in Hebrew. Just depends on where your position is on that.
Right.
If we are slaveholders to whoever holds the mortgage of our house, or in the case of the nation, whoever we've borrowed the money from, we are subservient to them, and we cannot do the things that we need to do. And so if we followed God's way, we would only, I don't know, spend what we have to spend.
What?
Right?
No, say it ain't so.
In debt, right?
Our credit card economy wouldn't exist? Is that what you're telling?
Right.
Oh, wow. Isn't that interesting? And we might be able to live some happier, healthier lives. And if you've got a job you truly hate and you're not, you know, up to your eyeballs in debt, you might be able to go, hey, maybe this isn't the job for me, and go find something better.
Yep.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry.
We are a balanced budget state. Can you imagine what would happen if they could ever get a bill passed at the national level that we had to be a balanced budget nation, budget neutral?
It'll never happen, though, because there's too much money sloshing around up there for people to stick their hands in. So
Yeah, and that's what I said out there about the lack of integrity and all that. It's just because...
What are your hot buttons?
The lack of integrity in people who are being...
slothful.
Who don't work, right? So... We have a whole. The only reason we have the problem that we have today is because we have people who went up there. That's not the only reason. Besides the moral and ethical stuff,
I was already leaning into my mic over here.
Not the only problem, but when you have people who have forgotten that the reason they are where they're at is they're there to serve, they're there to represent, and they are not there to fill their own pockets, to take care of their own constituents to the point where they get their own kickbacks, and that's the reason that we have all the debt is because they just really want to spend. But I also point the mirror back at the people.
Yep.
The people have allowed that to happen because they won't do what needs to be done to stop all that spending. They like all of the things that they get by spending extra. And so if a real, true, and honest political leader stood up and said, hey, we can fix this, but here's what's going to have to happen. We're going to have to cut the budget about 30% just so we can pay our own bills and maybe pay back our debt. But here's what you're going to lose. And the people would just go, oh, no, we can't have that.
Right.
Yeah, just keep borrowing it and then we'll let our kids pay for it. I mean, it's the people as much as it is the crooks that are lying in their own pockets.
It's one of those things that I try to teach my children, and that is that somehow we kicked out a king. And then turned around over the course of a couple hundred years and created a new aristocracy. We created a new ruling class. We have kings. We get rid of them every 4 to 8 years, but we created an entire ruling class of people that no longer truly answer to the people. They just don't. They come home, they say some nice things, and then they go back to their castles in D.C. and basically ignore us until it is time for another election.
Right.
And then they come back and make a bunch of promises, and we all know, right? Lawyers and politicians, don't trust a word out of either mouth.
Hey,
apologies to you. That would be on a national level.
Right, we're talking national.
It's around here, too.
Yeah, well, I try to be gentle. I've got uncles who served in the House here in Arkansas back in the day, so I try to be gentle to local politicians as best as possible, but when it comes to national politics,
the reason I say it comes back to the people is because the reason that what happened to Jesus was done by the leaders. It was not done by the people.
Right, right.
And so the people were following. He had tens of thousands of people that were following him, but it was the leaders who did not want to accept who he was. And
the changes that he wanted to bring.
Correct. Right. Correct.
And why did they not want to follow him? Because it would have cost them their power.
It would have cost
them
their power.
They would have had to surrender their power.
Yep. And it's the same spirit, but also much is given, much is required. So the people that are in the positions, in the position that you sit in this state, you're going to be held to a higher account because you sit in a position of leadership and authority over a state. And the same thing is true on a national level, all right, in a much larger way.
All right. Well, let me tell you who controls the power right now. Heidi. And Heidi is giving me the signal.
I see her
that
back
we are
us.
Coming down to the count. This is Kim Hammer hosting for Dave Ellswick here on 101.1 FM. Come back after the break. Welcome back to the Dave Ellswick Show. Kim Hammer, State Senator, hosting for Dave today. Out on a conference. I got the Bible guys in for this hour. Got Billy and Steve here, and I appreciate you guys joining me. Having a little bit of a discussion about some modern-day problems, a little bit about how God doesn't ignore the uncomfortable subjects. People just don't like to hear the uncomfortable answers that God gives.
Right, right.
And I think that's kind of what we're boiling down to as a society. God's got a solution for these problems. The question is, do you want to be obedient? And you know, dealing with a society that is becoming more and more rebellious toward authority only stands to reason why people are rebellious toward the authority of God. Nobody really wants to put themselves under submission to God, who's got the answers to the problems. Talked a little bit about debt. Let's run down the line and let's talk about slavery for a minute.
Okay.
Because that's kind of a topic that rolls around every once in a while. You got things being taught, debatable, being taught in school or not. It's out there, CRT and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
God never backed away from the subject of slavery, because he didn't back away from any problem that man was going to create, because once Adam and Eve screwed it up for all of us, he knew these problems were going to be coming in. Your thoughts about God's subject of slavery and how it was addressed and what he said?
It did not go away with the emancipation.
Okay.
What I mean by that is
nothing of man is going to solve
that
problem.
It's not. Yeah. But we did the right thing after a battle, and in the midst of a battle, and we changed what is still a common practice in many parts of the world today. And yes, God addressed it in the Word of God. And some, even our former president, made it appear that God was condoning. And what a lot of people don't realize is when God was given the commandments to Moses, he said, hey, you're going to see certain things that the other cultures do. Well, I don't want you to do it like them.
Right.
Even simple things like when they would boil a kid in its mother's milk, right? We look at that commandment and go, well, that's
kind of
stupid.
That would be a goat before anybody gets
not
freaked out about children.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. But it was, hey, this is one of the things that the nations do. I don't want you to do these things like them. And then God addressed the issue of slavery. Because it's not that he knew that it wasn't going away. But what he said to Israel, hey, when you have slaves, you are going to treat them, and he lists how they are to be treated. And by the way, there was a way of release for them at the end of the seventh year.
Yep.
So they were not to be treated like the nations treated them, but they were to treat them better and give them a day of rest. Right,
right. Right.
They weren't allowed to beat them. They weren't allowed to do certain things. And so God addressed that situation. God addressed the situation of divorce, right? It's not his ideal plan. He goes, but hey, if you got to do it, and obviously Jesus later clarified when he said it's because the hardness of your heart is why God gave that command.
Right.
And you could argue that was the same reason he had to give laws about slavery, is because people weren't going to change, but he's going to hold them accountable how they were going to do certain things that were done within cultures and within society.
Right.
And so that was kind of one of the things we were alluding to at the beginning, was that this nation was not only was it – people treat it that what happened with the slavery as horrific as it was, as we were the creators of it. And we weren't. But what we were the creators of was beginning the ball rolling for ending it.
Right. Right?
Because
right.
there were many nations that followed suit after we brought it to its end.
Yeah. And you have to understand that biblical slavery is a radically different thing than the slavery that we have in our minds based on American culture and American history. Slavery, biblical slavery, so let's say that somehow Steve and I had done business together, and suddenly I found myself in a position, my farm burned down, and I owe Steve $500,000, a significant amount of money. And I come to him and go, hey, look, there's no way I'm going to be able, my farm burned down, my barns are gone, my produce is all gone. I'm never going to be able to raise that $500,000. I will become your servant. Now, here's the great thing about what the Bible said. That is not a permanent position between us. That is a 7-year contract at maximum.
Right.
And until A, that debt is forgiven, and B, I am set free. So that is really a contract that says, hey, I owe you money, and I can't come up with the money, so I'm going to work for you until I've worked off my debt. And by the way, God said that could never be more than 7 years.
And by the way, and I'm going to insert the terms as to how I'm going to treat you like
correct.
A human
right.
being
right.
instead
right.
of like a possession.
Correct.
And what
correct.
We did in this nation was not the biblical model, and that's why we paid a heavy price because of the sin of what happened.
So do you think that is part of the reason why it is a tool of division on Satan's part today? Because it wasn't started right.
Yeah.
Wasn't handled right.
Yep.
But we did make effort to make it right.
And we have to understand that we inherited that system, right? It's not something we invented when we got here.
Right.
We inherited that. And our earliest founding documents, I know what the left is teaching right now, that we are the greatest evil that ever existed. But you go look at our founding documents, and we right from the very beginning we're talking about, how do we get rid of this? How do we solve this most unhuman thing that is going on in the world. How do we get rid of slavery? And we understood at the time, look, you can't. That's not a. There are just some band-aids you can't pull off all at once. Yeah. If you were to decide tomorrow we're going to pay off the national debt, you can't do it. You cannot get it done in a single day. And it took a couple of generations. It took several generations before we could go from where we were at to where we wanted to be. And guess what? That is the story of every person's life. You started off in one place and you're headed to another. So it is with a nation. A nation starts off in one place and you're headed to another. The only hope is that we are walking a moral and ethical path that has been ordained by God, and therefore we're walking to something better, not something worse.
Yeah.
All right. So Solomon used slaves.
Yep.
To build the temple.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, they were foreigners in the land. I forgot the number, like 185,000. 3,800 of them were the supervisors. They broke them up in the quarries, and, you know, others went into the woods to cut the woods and everything. Right, wrong, or what was a – give me a comparison, because
well,
Solomon
them,
used them to build the temple.
Well, he did, but most of them were what Billy was talking about. They were the indentured servants. It's not that they went necessarily and captured them from other lands and brought them
right
there for that purpose, but almost contractually, you know, almost like a wage, if you will.
And I started a moment ago to go, hey, you know what? It's not a lot different than what you're doing right now.
Right.
You owe money to somebody and you're working a job. That was essentially what slavery, quote-unquote, looked like in
You've
Israel.
Indentured yourself
right.
to whoever
right.
it is that you owe
right.
the money to.
And it was, remember, and one thing you can't compare, when God told Israel to go in and take the land, we cannot compare how we see things modernly and then what God said to do to a people that was in that land that he gave to the people of Israel. So most of those people were just conquered and then given a chance to become part of Israel, and some of it was just through servanthood. So it wasn't that they captured them, put them in chains, and then gave them a hammer and a chisel and said, go build this. It was done basically the way I was saying.
Yeah.
We'll get to the temple in a second, because we've brought that up because there's a movement about the temple, and we'll come back into that in a little bit. But I want to hit on one subject also about, you know, the Bible's perspective on dealing with it, because, you know, as they're showing on, you know, Fox News this morning down in New Orleans, they're not sure they can protect the citizens. You know, you go up to Chicago.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go to Chicago for nothing. I'm a Cubs fan, but I'll watch it on TV. There's no way I'd go up to Chicago right now.
Right.
There are certain pockets in this nation that are just becoming unsafe to travel. You might be safer. And I've been to Israel. I felt safer in Israel back in 85.
Oh, yeah.
Because every corner you stood on, there was somebody there with a gun to take care of you. Mm. Use the gun in the right way. So what about the Bible and what it says about crime? And, you know, what's the appropriate measures that are given to us biblically in order to help get our crime rate under control? What would y'all say from biblical examples?
Swiftly and severely.
Right. Okay. Right. It really is. And the let's not go to the big one. Let's not talk about murder yet. But first, let's talk about simple things like stealing. That if you were to steal something from somebody, let's use in a modern example of a car. The thief had to buy you five cars in return. So if you stole a sheep, right, the Bible gave the example is you had to return him four or five, depending on which the amount of the animal or whatever it was. If you kidnapped a person, you were put to death, right? So there were certain crimes that once you were convicted, the punishment was swift. And if you had to pay somebody back five Cadillacs, right, you would probably think twice about stealing one Cadillac the next time you found yourself in a position to steal a Cadillac, Mercedes, or whatever, you know, or a horse. And I think that would be, you know, restitution would be a great principle to get into people's lives, that you got to pay back. Not only give what you stole, but you got to give in addition to. And instead of this idea of just, well, we're just going to put you in these nice little housing units with, you know, cable live feed and three squares a day, and it's there's no
and before anybody judges us too hard, Steve and I both have spent a tremendous amount of time preaching in prisons, so we are certainly familiar with what that situation looks like, and we also understand that a bunch of those guys come from backgrounds that didn't leave them a lot of options, but that's part of the problem, right? We have become morally bankrupt enough that we allow that sort of thing to happen. When you don't punish criminals, you incentivize criminal behavior.
Yep.
And we've now a couple of generations where we just don't bother to punish criminals.
If there are no consequences for one's actions, they will never change. And that's really the biblical principle that God's laying out. Anytime you do, there's going to be a consequence for your action. And since we have taken away consequence except for, well, hey, go down here and hang out in this building for 5 years, and we're going to feed you 3 squares a day, and you're gonna, not only that, you're going to have internet soon, right? That's where they're getting to the place where they already got email, right? And then they got 5 or 6 TVs spread out all over the place, and so we're just hanging out. So what's disincentivizes me from wanting to steal further again?
Yeah, and when I make that statement that we don't punish criminals, I was looking at a Fox News morning brief, the sort of thing this morning, and one of the candidates for, I think, for governor of one of the states, and I don't remember who it was at this point, had to back off of his statement that
the senator from Pennsylvania
was it. Well, we're just going to release everyone who has been convicted of second degree murder or less. Well, no, wait a minute. Those are murderers. I mean, right. It's second degree, but that's murder.
If you really believe that, and I got to wrap it up, but if you really believe that, give me your home address, because when we release them, we're dropping them off on your doorstep in your neighborhood. That doesn't seem to work out so well as we see on other platforms either that are occurring right now. It all sounds good until they show up in your neighborhood, and then your tone changes, which means you probably didn't have a good solution in the first place. All right, got to take a break here on the Dave Ellswick Show. Got the Bible guys in. We're going to come back. Let's talk about the temple and a movement that's kind of going on and how it relates to what's happening in the world today. We'll come back here on the Dave Ellswick Show after the break. Welcome back to the Dave Ellswick Show. Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave, off on a conference. We got the Bible guys in, which is Billy and Steve. Been talking about some modern-day issues and what the Bible has to say about it, but we're going to kind of transition toward one thing I think that majority people, hopefully, are looking for, is the rapture of the end times. A lot of buzz about the end time. In fact, next week I'm going to be hosting for Dave one day, and I'll tell you what I'd like to do, just go ahead and get it out there so you can kind of be, you know, preparing your mindset for it. About the tribulation, is it a pre, mid, or a post exit out of here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can have different ideas about it, take different positions on it. The reality is, whenever the Lord says come, we're all going.
That's right.
You know, we'll find out who's right when we get there, as long as we're there.
Right.
We'll fix it after the fact. But
and in that particular moment, I don't think any of us will care that we were right or wrong. So
I'm just honored enough to poke you on the way up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the ones that are going to care are the ones that look around and realize they got left. They're the ones that are going to care. So we'll talk about that next week on the Bible Guys when I'm in here hosting, about the rapture. You know, is it before the tribulation, middle of the tribulation, end of the tribulation? And in the meantime, you know, there are folks that are kind of got this idea that they need to reestablish the temple and the sacrificial worship system that was, you know, in place in the Old Testament. Talk about that for a little bit, because that is kind of a movement among some out there. And what are the dangers of that? What are the positives? Just talk about it for a second.
Well, it always gets stirred up. And I know there's some people out there, any believers that are listening, know anything you hear, the catchphrase, the red heifers.
Right.
And so every few years, and this has been going back 20, 30 years probably, you know, that that in order for a temple to be rebuilt, they have to have a red heifer for the ritual impurity, for anybody that's touched a dead body, anybody that's unclean, the priest be able to go in and do what they do. And because of the vast majority of the end times views that people have, are that there is going to be a literal, physical, rebuilt temple for the Antichrist to kind of walk into and to, if you will, use the term, rule and reign from. So because of how people interpret those scriptures about the end, they go, we have to have these red heifers in order to get that temple back up to prepare for the anti-Messiah. So in the past, people have been excited about this possibility, because that means we're getting close to the end times, the temple's about to be rebuilt, the anti-Messiah's about to reveal himself, we're about to walk into that period of time. Well, now there's been a group of people, and as far as I know, it's mainly within some of the circles that Billy and I run, that they're excited to see the temple rebuilt because they want to see the reinstitution of the actual sacrificial system. They want to see blood sacrifices again. They want to see this whole system. And it really troubles me in a big way, because they have missed the whole purpose for what Messiah came to do.
Right.
I mean, you can't read certain scriptures like in the book of Hebrews and that, where it talks about how he paid that price once and for all, how he became the high priest, how he offered himself for our sins. Even going back into the book of Isaiah in chapter 53, when it was the prophecy about the coming of the Messiah, it says his soul would be an offering for sin. And so I we talk about all the time that we could see how in a millennial period of time when Jesus is back, how there could be grain offerings and things like that when people are living in a peaceful time when they're getting their harvest and they go and that's something that can be talked about. But for people to be excited about the possibility of offering blood again seems to be
– especially for sin. Right,
yeah, right.
One of those blood offerings is for sin. And I'm sorry, the offering that was required for that was taken care of a couple thousand years ago.
Yep.
So I don't understand people who think or who are excited by the fact that they're going to get the opportunity. Because I know people who, if the temple were rebuilt tomorrow, they'd be on a plane going, I'm going to go get my sacrifice done.
Yep.
Your sacrifice is done, period.
Yep. Amen.
And that drives men to look to man for the solution of a problem that man created, which is a revolving door that you never get out of,
right,
if that's your approach.
Right.
Yep.
So go back a little bit deeper. Why did God set up the sacrificial system in the first place?
Man, it's weird. I was getting ready to say, it was like in my head.
Yeah, well, ESPN thoughts. But
that's
anyway.
Right. So he, when he first showed Moses, he said to build it according to the pattern that you were shown on the mountain. And then the writer of the book of Hebrews quotes that scripture. That the tabernacle and then eventually the temple, the whole Levitical system, the Ark of the Covenant, all of these things were given based off the pattern of what Moses saw in the heavens. And so it was an earthly practice and representation of what was going to be done and what is being done in the heavens.
Right.
And what Jesus came to ultimately do was to be that ultimate sacrifice, that pure lamb without spot, without blemish, without wrinkle, without anything, who voluntarily offered himself for our sins on behalf of that system that was established. And so when that system was established based on the heavenly model, why would we want to then ignore the heavenly model and going back to do
right
what the earthly model said? You know, I can't. There's many things that I can see both sides of any argument. I cannot, as many times as I've tried to look at the other side of that one, I cannot look at the other side of that one and think that people are excited.
That's like somebody being cured from a disease and then want to get back into the disease so they can be cured again.
Right.
I mean, that's screwed up thinking
and
is what that is.
And beyond that, I am concerned for the souls of those who would do that, who would go and participate in that sort of thing. To me, it is a form of rejection of the Messiah.
Yeah.
And look, once you have been introduced and followed the Messiah, to reject him after that is super dangerous.
There's a verse in the book of Hebrews chapter 10, and if you just read it on its surface, it looks like it's talking about people who have rejected Jesus. And it says that it says on the law of Moses, in the law of Moses, that those who by two or three witnesses are held account for what they do. And then he goes on to say, of how much worse punishment will it be for those who have taken the blood of the covenant and trampled underfoot
right
the blood of the Messiah? And what people miss on that is they think it's just talking about somebody who's just backslidden, who just went back to things of the world. Context was, he was actually addressing people who were going back to the sacrificial system.
Yeah, yeah.
These were people that were getting a lot of pressure from the Romans, and they decided to go back to the sacrificial system. That's the context of that verse. And that's why when people are saying, hey, we need to go back and get ready for this, I'm going, man, you need to really think about what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
But what pressure was Rome putting on them to go back?
Well, because of the persecution that was becoming onto the believers. So the Jews were not being persecuted as much because they were an accepted religion within Rome.
Right.
But when the Christians were coming out of Judaism, and they were saying, you guys are different. You're not like the Jews. So when the persecution came to the Christians, they went back. Some of them went back into Judaism because there was safety
to avoid
there.
The persecution.
Yeah. And so they would go back to that system so to avoid the persecution, and that's what the context of that was.
Man put his hands to the plow and looketh back is not fit for the kingdom
that's
of
right.
God.
Right. Amen.
So we'll pick up on this topic when we come back next week. I got you guys in here, and we'll talk about the rapture. Just say this one point. If Christ washes away your sins, he washes them away forever.
That's right.
Amen.
You don't have to revert back to a system that was proven to be inadequate. Christ is adequate to give you forgiveness of your sins by asking him to forgive you.
Amen.
And give you a gift that he paid for on the cross of Calvary. Debt paid in full.
Amen.
You don't have to go back in. All right, guys, I appreciate you being here on the Dave Ellsworth Show. Kim Hammer, State Senator. I'll be back at 9. I've got Dr. Kent Corso coming on. It is Suicide Awareness Month. We're going to talk about suicide prevention and suicide awareness, and we'll talk about it in a positive sense, but we'll be realistic, too. Something you may want to tune in. If nothing else, you'll be equipped to recognize other people that may be going through it, thinking about it, that you're not even aware of. So come on back at 9 o'clock and rejoin me here on the Dave Ellsworth Show on 101.1 FM, The Answer. Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave Ellsworth, who's out on a conference. So thank you for joining me for the next hour. We're going to put a focus on suicide awareness because this is Suicide Awareness Month here in the month of September. I know some of you may be uncomfortable talking about that. Some of you may even feel like that doesn't apply to you because you're not thinking about it. You don't know anybody that's experienced suicide or that's been impacted by suicide. But the reality is it may be around you and you don't even know it. And one of the things I would like to do is just participate in raising the awareness of suicide and specifically suicide prevention, not just because it's a month where we stop to put special emphasis on it, but because it's something that goes around 12 months out of the year. And one of the things I think that we need to be doing or that we need to do is to raise the awareness so that we can be more sensitive to it, but also so that we can be equipped to deal with it and help make that conversation happen today. I invited a guest who's been on the Kim Hammer Show, a show that I sponsor here on 101.1 FM, The Answer, on Saturdays from noon until 1. I've had this gentleman, Dr. Kent Corso, on. He is a licensed clinical health psychologist and board-certified behavioral analysis who's worked in multiple disciplinary academic and medical settings for the last 15 years. And he has specific areas of expertise in the area of suicide. So, Kent, I appreciate you joining me here on the Dave Ellsworth Show this morning.
Glad to be here with you, sir. Happy to help.
Thank you very much. Well, let's kind of get into it because I've got an hour and, you know, we got a lot of material that we could cover within that hour. Let me start off with just this question. How does the thought of suicide get into one's head in the first place?
Suicide comes to mind for many people. In fact, we see about 48,000 suicides per year in America, and those are just the deaths by suicide. It comes to many, many, many more people's minds. So let's just start there with some numbers here. Many, many people have thought about suicide once in their lives, but only a very small percentage of them actually attempt, and an even smaller percentage will actually die by suicide. And it's just part of the human problem-solving process. In other words, when people come into contact with a circumstance in life or a series of circumstances, stressors, if it seems hopeless, if it seems like too much to handle, they think of ways to escape. And one of those ways to escape, of course, is to end one's life.
And let me back up, because one thing I didn't note in your talking about your credentials, share with the folks with regards to what you specialize in and why it makes it, valuable that you're on the show today.
So I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst, and I'm also a suicidologist, which is someone who specializes in the study and reduction of suicide. I should also back up, and one caveat is that if we're really going to have a valuable conversation about suicide prevention, we need to have a very direct one. It needs to be very clear and very frank. So what this means is if you are have experienced something like this, if you have lived experience, a family member, a friend, a loved one who's died by suicide, if you're triggered, please take care of yourself first. We just want to give people a heads up that we will have a very honest and direct conversation about that.
And is that not part of the problem, is that for years people have kind of tap danced around the subject matter, either because, and well, let me back up. First of all, it seems like historically this is a subject matter that a lot of people have just kind of avoided for whatever reasons. Am I right or wrong in that perception?
That's correct, sir. So people felt shame about their own, felt ashamed of family members who have died by suicide, talked about suicide, attempted suicide, and there's a lot of stigma attached to this issue, and that is one of the biggest barriers to people seeking help, is they are ashamed to come forward.
Are people afraid to admit that they might have these thoughts in fear of what they don't know? They know they've got it, but it's kind of like taking a lid off something. You know, once you take the lid off, whatever's inside is going to come out, kind of like one of those cans, you know, that has the exploding device on the inside, the little plastic worm. You know, when you pull that lid off, you better be ready, because what's coming out is coming out.
Right. Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of it. So when someone feels suicidal or thinks of suicide for the first time, it's pretty foreign. It's not familiar to them. And they judge themselves. They worry that since this is unfamiliar territory, they don't know what they might do, or they don't know how things will turn out. And it can be very frightening. So there's that piece of it, that it's uncharted territory. The other aspect of it is that they worry how others will judge them or treat them, whether people will just call the police, call 911. Sometimes in rural areas, the police assist with lots of EMS calls and things like welfare checks to people's residents. So there's a lot of fear of the unknown, saying it at work. Will that get me fired? Will that lead my boss to have less faith in me, less confidence in my ability to perform and do my job? So all sorts of different deterrents here. And let's be honest, some of these suicidal folks are parents, and maybe they don't want their children to sort of know, because it maybe sets a bad example or might lead their child to become suicidal. So any different angle we can think on this is pretty fair game.
The difference between thinking about death and thinking about suicide, I was listening to a conversation within the last week, and that was one of the thoughts that was brought up, is it unnatural to think about death, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're thinking about suicide. And how do you differentiate between the two so that, you know, you can be comfortable talking about death, but doesn't necessarily indicate that you're thinking about suicide?
So that's a great point, and sadly, it's a point that is not well known among healthcare providers, mental health providers, and even everyday citizens. So thoughts of death are actually quite common, and both suicidal thoughts and thoughts of death, and I don't mean the type of thoughts where you're planning for your funeral arrangements or things like that, or doing a will. What I mean is when someone says to themselves, wow, I wish I could just fall asleep and not wake up, or I wish I could just go to sleep for a week, it's an escape-oriented mindset. Again, it's trying to avoid dealing with something that is very overwhelming, something very painful, whether that's emotional pain or physical pain. And that's what those death thoughts and suicidal thoughts have in common, is that they are escape-oriented mindsets. Where they're different, however, is it's much more common for people to have those death thoughts. It's sometimes called morbid thoughts, or they are sometimes called morbid thoughts. And they're not very high risk, so people don't reliably, consistently have those thoughts and then engage in suicidal behaviors or suicide attempts. But those thoughts about death can grow into suicidal thoughts. So let me use a quick example. So I might have just lost my job, and now I'm thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to support my family? How will I pay my bills? What's going to happen to us in life? And I might think to myself, wow, I wish I could just escape all of this. I wish we could just all go to another country and be okay, or another place. Or maybe if I fell asleep, I could avoid having to deal with this. Well, that's the death thoughts. But when it becomes suicidal thoughts is when I see myself playing a role in facilitating my death or enacting my death. So it sort of gets from, wow, I wish I could just go away for a long time and escape this, to, maybe I can make myself go away for a long time. So it sounds like a subtlety and a nuance, but it really does make an immense difference as to whether someone's experiencing those death thoughts versus suicidal thoughts. Again, the suicidal thoughts are associated with higher risk, and the death thoughts are lower risk. But again, they can grow into suicidal thoughts.
If someone is going down that path of suicidal thoughts, what are some of the exit ramps that they can use to get off that road? What are, I know there's a, you know, after national legislation was passed, and we passed it here in the state of Arkansas, you can, you know, call the 988 number, and that'll direct you to some resources to where you can get some help. But just maybe for somebody that's listening and is maybe going down that road of suicidal thoughts, what are some of the exit ramps that they can take to get to the help that they need, and what are some things they can do for themselves to help get to where they can get out of that thought pattern?
So what's tough about this is that about 80% of people who have suicidal thoughts will show some sort of signs. So either they will seem different, they will ultimately seem different than themselves. So whether that is more withdrawn, whether they are less social, less talkative, whether their mood, the way their facial expressions look, their emotions are kind of more down or even more irritable. 80% will show signs, and those signs could even be talking about it, saying things like, well, I think I'll go home and drink my dinner, or, well, you know, that's going to be a terrible situation next week, but it doesn't matter anyway. I won't be here to see it, or things like that that suggest a foreshortened future. 80% of people who are suicidal will show that, but about 20% were never going to see signs. And this is important. The people who will never see signs, it's because they escalate so quickly, or they are absolutely determined to die, and they don't want any help. They don't want anyone to stop them. And so because there is an impulsive aspect to suicide, it makes it harder for us to see the signs. It also, to your question, makes it harder for us to help ourselves. The mindset of being suicidal is characterized by racing thoughts, very negative thoughts, negative emotions. Again, whether that's anxiety, depression, irritability, frustration, feeling hopeless, helpless, worthless, powerless, feeling like you are a burden to others. So all of those feelings don't typically facilitate positive help-seeking behavior. And when all of those emotions and thoughts are churning, oftentimes our bodies get worked up too. So when we think about the body's stress response and adrenaline and the fight or flight response, that's often kicked in or turned on. And that can make it very challenging to make logical, rational decisions. So love what you've suggested, Mr. Hammer, which is call 988. We've been working for over a decade on getting 988 to be the new suicide and crisis lifeline, okay. Sort of comparable to 911.
All right. But hey, also, let me interrupt you. Sure, we'll come back on that. I got to take a break. I got to see the schedule, and we'll be back here to the Dave Ellsworth Show in just a minute. My guest right now is Dr. Kent Corso. If you want to go up there looking him up on, you know, on Facebook, or, you know, go Google him, he'll pull up and you can see some of his credentials that makes him the expert to be on the Dave Ellsworth Show to be talking about suicide. September being Suicide Awareness Month. We'll be back in just a minute with Dr. Corso. Welcome back to the Dave Ellsworth Show. This is State Senator Kim Hammer filling in for Dave, and I have Dr. Kent Corso joining us here on the Dave Ellsworth Show. It is September, which is Suicide Awareness Month, and so we are trying to dedicate a little time here on the Dave Ellsworth Show to talk about the subject of suicide. Granted, it's not a comfortable topic to be talking about. You may not even feel it applies or is applicable to you, but in reality, it probably touches more of us than we realize, and if things don't get under control, it probably will reach out and touch us in a way, either directly or indirectly, that we will know somebody. Ken, let me ask you, as far as the percentage of people that are touched by suicide in America, what percentage of people are actually touched by it, either through not those that commit it, but those that are left behind to survive the act itself, or know somebody that has been touched by suicide? Are there any statistics out there?
Sure. There are some statistics showing that for every person who dies by suicide, there are upwards of 35 people who have attempted. And so when you think about this, even though we talk about having about 48,000 suicides per year in America, there are many, many people who have thought of it, many what we call loss survivors. And that is when someone you know or love dies by suicide. We also have attempt survivors, and those are people who attempt and live through it. When we look at statistics of how many people are affected by suicide, there's some research that shows that 6 people are affected for every suicide death. So I'm not a mathematical wizard, but 48,000 times 6 would be roughly 300,000 people every year are affected by suicide.
So let me ask you this question then, and I've just got a random list of questions, and we're trying to plug them in as we go. Can a person ever get out of it once they've experienced it? You know, it's like alcoholics. You know, if somebody's an alcoholic or they're a drug user, they realize they got a problem. They go get the therapy. They go get the help that they need. They get it under control in their life. But one of the things they say is that you always live with it, always having to be on guard. Is it the same thing for people that have experienced suicide? And what if somebody has attempted it and they've recovered from the moment? What are the things they have to do in order to prevent it in the future?
So it doesn't necessarily work like other disorders, things like depression, things like post-traumatic stress disorder, or things like alcoholism. What we know is if we do not address the suicide risk, it does progress over time. But if someone does seek treatment, it can be highly effective. Some of the best research on treating suicide and suicide attempts has shown that if we give a very high quality form of treatment, we can reduce attempts by 76%. Now, just to put that into context, when we think of CPR, right, if someone loses consciousness and we try to do CPR, the effectiveness of CPR is about 30 to 35%. So consider that that many people in our community know CPR and are ready to try to use it, even if it's just a citizen operating under the good law. But when it comes to suicide, treatments can be up to 76% effective. So that gives you the sense of how, if more people learn how to help with the problem, how what kind of a dent we can make in this issue. One other piece here to answer your question, Senator Hammer, is that most people who attempt suicide and live will never attempt again. And there's this experience they have where when they either wake up in the hospital room and realize they had attempted suicide and lived, or whether they wake up wherever they attempted suicide. Some people attempt and live through it and don't seek medical attention. They sort of think to themselves, wow, I'm really grateful to be alive. I can't believe I did that. I don't really want to die. So it is something that people can improve upon. It's not necessarily something that they will battle and struggle and feel the tension with their entire lives.
And I was going to ask you that question. What is the, based on your experience and people that you've worked with, consulted with, the last thought that goes through a person's mind before they commit suicide, if they have survived that attempt and come back to talk about it? What are the last thoughts that went through their mind, and then what are the first thoughts that come through their mind once they realize they survived it? Hit on that a little deeper, if you would.
Sure. I can certainly share a personal story recently that's very recent, but we don't know what those last thoughts are specifically, but what we do know is that they tend to be again, hopelessness, helplessness, feeling like this is the only answer, like there are no other options they have except to end it because their problems are just insurmountable. So that those are the thoughts that tend to be right before they die. And then, again, the thoughts when they come to, sometimes it's, thank God I'm alive. So sometimes it's very faith-based or God-centric. Other times there is a small percentage of people who will wake up and say, dang, I'm so worthless, I couldn't even kill myself. And that's, again, a very small percentage of people, and they tend to be suicidal chronically. Just a personal story. So I had a friend who texted me about 2 weeks ago. He's in the process of killing himself. He had locked himself in his garage, closed it, turned on the car, opened the windows, and was revving the engine. And I called him immediately when I saw the text, and I talked to him, and he had become sleepy already because of the carbon monoxide. And just talking to him, trying to walk him through, go ahead and turn off the ignition, prompting him, trying to encourage him. One of the things that I had said to him was, if this is really the right decision for you, you don't have to make it today. You can make it any day this month, any day this year. But tonight, let's make a different decision. And ultimately, I was able to talk him through turning off the car, escaping the garage, getting fresh air. And he lived. And the following day, he texted me and we spoke. And he said, I'd like to thank you for what you did last night. I will never do that again. That was the dumbest thing I could have done. I will absolutely find any other solution but that one. So, it's a clear example of what we know from the research, which is that people who are suicidal don't really want to die.
Okay.
They just want out of their circumstance.
All right. Got to interrupt you. We got to take a hard break. We'll come back after this. We'll pick up with that story, and then I want to talk about people who deal with survivors, not them themselves, but they're the survivors that have to deal with it. Come back in a minute. Welcome back to the Dave Ellsworth Show. This is State Senator Kim Hammer filling in for Dave, who is Oz. I've got Dr. Kent Corso on the line with me. We're talking about suicide prevention or suicide awareness, if you would. Month of September set aside to recognize that. So I appreciate you, Dr. Corso, taking time out to join here on the Dave Ellsworth Show. So for those that, you know, like your friend, had you not received the call, had he not got the intervention that he needed in order to get out of that situation, and thank God that he realized that's not a pathway, a deterrent for the next time around, so that's a good experience. But let's just say that somebody walked in and found him, and it hadn't turned out so well. The survivors of those that commit suicide, talk about what they experience and talk about the help that they need to get and some of the issues that they experience being the survivor of someone that committed suicide.
So we call those survivors loss survivors or suicide loss survivors, and they deal with a whole host of baggage and everything from the stigma that people already have for suicide. Now that sort of a stain or stigma is left on their family. If there are children, those children are now at a slightly higher risk for suicide themselves, having a parent who died by suicide. There's the burden of the surviving parent having to explain to their children, even one's own parents. So if the person who died by suicide, their parent has to deal with the death of their child and question, what did I do wrong? So all of those loved ones who survive a suicide question, what could we have done differently? And sometimes they blame themselves. If maybe there was some discord within the family, within the marriage, they'll blame themselves. And that's sort of emotional and mental health consequences that they don't need either. So there's just a trail of damage that suicide leaves for the survivors.
I know sometimes there are notes that are left. Anything regarding notes or messages that are left as to significance in what's left in those notes. And I know that's kind of just maybe a bizarre question, but I always wonder about somebody that leaves a note for somebody. How does that play into what the person was thinking up to the time they committed suicide And how does a family member deal with a note that is left? And maybe that's just too impossible of a question to answer, but I just want to put it out there anyway.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. There, I think many people feel cheated, and so I'll elaborate. Let's pretend that my wife killed herself, so and left me a note. So let me get this straight. You took the time to write a note, but you couldn't take the time to talk to me about what you were experiencing, and now I'm left with the aftermath. That feels really unfair. So I think oftentimes when a note is left, on one hand, there's one thought process or line of thinking that says, okay, well, at least it helps explain why the person did it, and it helps the loved ones. Maybe it softens the blow a bit because they have some sense of what the thought process was that drove the person to end their lives. On the other hand, there's also this experience of, well, now I'm left holding all the baggage, and you took the time to do that, but you couldn't take the time to reach out to me so I could help you, so I could prevent this. So I think it's probably a mixed bag.
All right. So you mentioned a while ago some of the indicators of what, you know, suicide might be presenting it as, you know, whether it's depression, change in a personality, et cetera. You know, in a normal course of a day, a person could, you know, possibly present. Yesterday, I'll be honest with you, was kind of a rough day for me. Somebody looked at me in a snapshot of time. They might have said, I wonder if Kim is. And how do you get into that conversation with somebody, which, by the way, I wasn't. But how do you get into that conversation with somebody knowing the awkwardness that maybe you just misread the person and you don't want to, you know, you don't want to prejudge them based on what you might see in a snapshot of time? And how do you just get into that conversation with a person without it being awkward?
So I don't know that we can do that. So it depends on your relationship with the person. Expect it to be an awkward conversation, period. And that often helps break down the barriers to people asking the question. When we look over the last 50 years of suicide research, we've never seen a time where we've reduced the suicide rate, even by, let's say, 20%, and then sustained that lower rate year after year. One of the reasons why is because people don't ask the question. They sort of balk at the awkwardness. They retreat. And so just accept that it will be an awkward conversation. For some people, say, would you rather deal with the awkwardness of asking the question and saying, hey, are you thinking of killing yourself or ending your life? Or would you rather deal with the guilt that if that person dies, that you could have been a part of the solution? So one of the best ways to start the conversation is to make an observation, just a personalized observation. Again, Senator Hammer, you were not suicidal yesterday, but let's just pretend I was working beside you and noticed your demeanor was different. I said, hey, sir, you don't seem like yourself. Something seems different. So just a general comment, because what that does is it communicates to the person that you care and that you are paying attention to them, so that when you follow up with a question like, I know this might sound odd, sir, but are you thinking of killing yourself or ending your life? When we know from the research that we have to ask that direct question. So if we make an observation first, just a general one, it can help sort of open up the conversation. It's still going to be awkward. But people, if you ask, how are you doing? How are you? We're so used to saying fine or great. We don't really tell people how we're feeling. So by asking the question directly, it lets them know exactly what you're interested in and that you are willing to hear their answer, whatever that might be.
Thus the importance of removing the stigma, because sometimes when you ask somebody that question, the thought process of being judgmental is introduced into the conversation, and that should not be the intent at all, or that you're questioning the person's stability necessarily, even though that you are. But again, if you tap dance around the subject matter and you just don't come straight out, then you may be avoiding, who knows, you may be even making it worse. Maybe that person would be, you know, well, I need to hide my actions. I need to be a better actor. I need to be where people won't notice so I can finish what I'm thinking about starting. So removing the stigma is a big contributor to being able to ask that question directly without fear of repercussions, misreading somebody, or anything else. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment. Something else is we're never going to make it worse. So don't ever be afraid of asking. For the listeners out there, don't ever be afraid of asking because you think you might trigger someone. That's not how it works. There's no research that shows when we ask that question, it's going to make someone think of suicide or it's going to make a suicidal person worse. And one other thing just to back up, if someone kills themselves, that's not my fault. That's when someone chooses to end their lives, that is their decision. And so even though some people may blame themselves, we do want to make sure it's clear that we can't save everybody. If someone truly wants to die, they're going to do it. So we have to be careful not to fall into this trap that we can save everybody and that we're going to reduce the suicide rate to zero or that if someone killed themselves I could have saved them. Well, maybe you could have been a part of the solution, but I wouldn't convince yourself that you could have saved them.
Are we, in comparison to other nations, are we winning the battle of suicide? Are we in the middle of the pack? Where are we in the pack?
Yeah, so we're not doing great. And if we're talking about Arkansas specifically, Arkansas is doing slightly worse than the U.S. as a whole. We do know suicide is worse in rural areas. One of the things that makes suicide higher in the United States than comparable nations is our access to firearms. Now, this is not, I want to be clear, this is not some sort of a slam against the Second Amendment. In fact, to say that it's silly for people to say, well, you either have to love suicide prevention or love firearms, but you can't love both. And that's hogwash. You can love the Second Amendment and love suicide prevention. This is not an all-or-nothing type of solution. But it is a fact that people use whatever they have available to them. And since firearms are highly lethal, when those happen to be available, and they do tend to be more firearm owners in rural areas, when they do happen to be available, that makes them more likely to be used. It's just that simple. For example, when we talk to people who have survived a firearm attempt, 24% made the decision to do it within 5 minutes. And 70% of people who have attempted suicide by firearm and survived made the decision in 60 minutes. So what we're really talking about is delaying access when people are upset, when they are depressed, when they are having some life stressors, delaying their access to firearms, even just buying 1 hour, could potentially reduce the firearm suicides by 70%. And just to be clear, the percentage of suicides annually that are done by firearms in the U.S. are about 10%. So it is by far people choose to kill themselves.
All right, you broke up just there, just as you were giving the percentage. Make that statement again, if you would.
Sure. So the number one way people kill themselves in the U.S. is by firearms, accounting for 53% of suicides in America.
All right. And that was one question, and we'll get it after the break, but let me go ahead and get it out there. The methods of which people use to commit suicide, are there any statistics out there that can show why people pick the method that they do? I know what you're saying about time delay and access and everything, but, you know, somebody jumping off a building, somebody jumping off a bridge, somebody doing an overdose, somebody, you know, whatever methodology it is that they're choosing, is there any rationale, is there any alignment to the fact between the time they make the decision to commit suicide and the method that they choose? You said your friend a while ago got inside the car, you know, and it was going to be, you know, death by carbon monoxide. What is it that's in somebody's head when it comes to the choice that they're going to make? We'll come back after break. You're on the Dave Ellswick Show. Welcome back to the Dave Ellswick Show. This is Kim Hammer, State Senator, hosting for Dave today, who is out. I've got Dr. Kent Corso. Subject is talking about suicide, with September being Suicide Awareness Month. So, Dr. Corso, where I left off was about the method of the choice that people make as far as what they're going to use as their method of committing suicide. What does data or information show as far as why people pick the method that they do?
There are a variety of reasons people pick the method they do, but aside from the 20% where it happens very, very quickly, it's a highly personalized decision. So, for example, I mentioned in an earlier segment today of a friend of mine who was trying to kill himself via carbon monoxide in his car. In his garage, his rationale was it would be a very peaceful way to go, so no pain. Other people think about the cleanup of their body, and so they choose a certain method because they don't want their loved ones to either have to clean it up or what they know that someone will find them. So sometimes they choose a method and a setting so that their loved ones don't find them. There is a myriad of reasons, but they tend to be highly personalized for those who are thinking about it for a while in advance. And it does include oftentimes the least pain or suffering.
And I want to emphasize again that people can call 988. That's the recognized national number. If you call that number, they'll get you to the Arkansas resources based on where you live. Do you know, and I'm asking because I don't know, so I'm asking you, for somebody that needs help because somebody has committed suicide, is that a number that they can call? Or what about somebody that has experienced the death of a loved one by suicide? Where do they go and what are the resources they can get access to?
So anyone can call 988. It's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. So anyone can call that at any time. And if they cannot help you, they will refer you to other folks. If you have survived the death of a loved one, one online resource that's helpful is suicidology.org. And I'm sure we can post that afterwards because suicidology is not a term most people typically spell.
We'll get that up. Dave will probably get it up on his, but I'll get it up on my website, thekimhammershow.com, heard Saturday noon until 1 here on 101 FM or on a podcast. So I'll make sure to get that up on my website, if nothing else, and people can go up there and check that out. Are there organizations out there that people, they scam people? I mean, you know, people like to take advantage of other people when they're going through a hard time, even the one that may be thinking about suicide. Are there organizations or groups out there that, you know, have been branded as scammers that you would care to make people aware of, or none out there that you know of?
I don't know about scammers, but what I would say is two very reputable organizations are AAS, the American Association of Suicidology, and that's, again, suicidology.org. The other organization is AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and that's AFSP.org. So I'd point people in the direction of those two resources. Certainly SAMHSA, you know, the HHS, the Health and Human Services Department has some resources. The CDC and your community mental health clinic or hospital will definitely have some helpful resources that wouldn't be scamming.
Okay. I want to get you back on and probably do one of my shows the next couple of weeks, and I'll try to coordinate with you because I'm down to like 3 minutes. But some other things I'd like to get back on and talk about is that when somebody goes out and commits a crime, then they commit suicide. Is that part of their suicide pack? That's one thing I'd like to get you back on to talk about, because we see that a lot where somebody will go into a, you know, whatever situation. They'll kill a bunch of people, like school shootings or businesses. They end up taking their life. Did they go in with that thought process in mind, or once they got in there and they did their deed, they realized there was no way out, and then they decided to take their life? Different age populations and also different culture populations and the rates among the different cultures. Are there things that make one culture maybe more inclined to think about suicide above the other, and what's contributing to that? I do want to finish, and so I'd like to have you back on just talk about some other subjects on this. But let me finish on this note, because I think it's important. I feel that my faith is a strong component in my life to help me battle against a lot of things. Honestly, I've never been suicidal. I think about death because I deal with death in the role that I serve in, you know, as a chaplain and also a pastor. It's just part of life, you know, do a lot of funerals. Doesn't make me suicidal. I think about it. But as far as a faith component contributing to a person's ability to ward off or fight suicidal thoughts, or somebody that maybe is recovering from somebody having committed suicide, in a minute or a minute and a half, talk about the faith component, being it valuable or of no value at all.
Sure. So the key distinction here is whether or not the person is of faith to begin with. If someone's an atheist or an agnostic, faith is probably not going to be very helpful. However, among those who are practicing a particular faith, and we're mainly talking Judeo-Christian, although the studies have been done in other faiths, faith is a strength. It is a resource that reduces one's risk. It can increase one's outcomes with everything from depression and anxiety to suicidal thinking. So without a doubt, if someone does have a faith-based background or that is one of their coping tools, it can be very effective as a coping tool. One other lens that the research shows is that it's a deterrent. So people in a, again, Judeo-Christian background may say, you know what, I don't want to go to hell, so that's the only thing keeping me alive. And it happens to work that over time, it will give them a chance to find other coping strategies and emerge from their dark place.
All right. And I'll get you back on. I want to talk deeper about how we compare to other nations, what other nations are doing or other parts of the state, you know, our nation, not just like nations outside America, but within the nation, what other states are doing that are having better results that maybe we need to be taking a look at doing ourselves. And then just a few other things. So I just really want to say I appreciate you being on the show today. I hope it does raise awareness. I hope that people have had some of their questions answered. And I'll look forward to getting you back on along with a few other experts. Any final thoughts before we finish up for the day?
The only thing I'd say is if you are struggling, help is available and it works. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Do you mind if I put your contact information up on my website or ways that people
Please
can
do.
Contact you? Okay. All right.
Sure.
I'll get that up on the KimHammerShow.com website and you can reach out. He's been on several times. I can speak from just observing the way in which he presents information, a good resource for you to have, Dr. Kent Corso. Thank you very much. This is Kim Hammer, State Senator, filling in for Dave Ellswick, who is off today. I'll be back on next week one day to fill in for him. Hope that the show will be rewarding for you to listen to. And again, I appreciate you listening today. I host a show every Saturday at KimHammerShow.com, heard here on 101.1 FM, The Answer, from noon until 1, or you can pick it up on the podcast platforms. Again, thank you for listening to the Dave Ellswick Show, and hope you have a great rest of the day. Remember, 988 is the number to call. If you're having thoughts, you know somebody that's maybe actively looking to do it, or you're one that has survived somebody that did it, you need help to resources, call 988. Have a great day.
Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.